This podcast brought to you by the English Department at Florida State University.
Hi, I'm Eric Schlick, and I'm here to introduce Kate Kimble. Kate Kimble is not just a writer. She is a freak of nature. She has the most amazing work ethic of anyone I know. If you've met Kate, you know she has the supernatural ability to accomplish an impossible number of things all at once. I would say she's a juggler or a multitasker, that she wears many hats. But the weird thing is that while I'm trying to finish one thing, like roll out of bed in the morning or brush my teeth, Kate's already done 20 others, and she did them all at the exact same time. At any one moment, Kate is rewriting a draft of her novel, studying for prelims, teaching a composition course at FSU, teaching a composition course at TCC, grading 7 student essays, commenting on the stories of her peers for workshop, working out at the gym, processing blood tests in a hospital lab, delivering a baby, teaching a teenage boy how to put a condom on a banana at a Planned Parenthood to prevent the conception of an unwanted pregnancy, not the same baby, modeling naked for an art class, sketching a portrait of herself modeling naked in the same art class, playing a piano concerto by Chopin, watching 3 French movies on Netflix, finishing the last season of Mad Men, dispatching a helicopter to pick up a hiker who has been attacked by a grizzly bear in the middle of the woods, washing the hands of a corpse in a morgue, and downing a plate of sushi. I wouldn't be surprised if Kate were doing all of this right now at this very moment. We should all take a look just to be sure. You're probably thinking, Eric, surely you're not saying that Kate is doing all of these things simultaneously. Surely you're using hyperbole to make a point. Surely you don't mean that she could be in 2 places at once. That would defy the laws of physics. If you're thinking that, you're wrong. Because I figured it out. I know her secret. You see, I have the suspicion that Kate Kimble is in possession of a time turner. She's able to bend the laws of physics to her will. She's a real-life Hermione Granger. And everyone who's read Harry Potter knows that Harry and Ron have nothing on Hermione. Kate Kimble is a fiction PhD student at Florida State University. She received her MFA from Virginia Tech. Her work has appeared in The Hawaii Review, Weber, The Contemporary West, Ellipsis, The Chaffee Review, Arcadia, Inkspill, The Midwest Magazine, and Storyscape, among others. Her novel was a semi-finalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award competition in 2011. Her work was also nominated for a Pushcart Prize by Arcadia Magazine and has won other awards. She has worked over 50 jobs, 50, many at the same time, as I said, and is from Salt Lake City. Her work sometimes draws on these things. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Kate Kimble.
Okay. Thank you for that introduction. Yeah, some of my jobs, many jobs. Thank you for coming out tonight. Thanks to Sakina and Colleen for hosting and for everyone taking their time out of their busy schedules. Thank you to my students for coming and supporting me. I know you're just curious to see if I write well, but I appreciate it. I am going to read a piece tonight from a recent piece that I wrote here at FSU, but it draws on a time in my life when I was doing my Master's of Fine Arts at Virginia Tech. And my last semester of my MFA, I had the unfortunate experience of getting diagnosed with a brain tumor. And they didn't know what it was. It was very confusing. I was having seizures. I couldn't drive. And I was graduating. And later found out that it was lymphoma, and that doesn't show up for a long time. And now I have that battle going on. But at the time, I was doing what many students do. I was working at a crappy job. But my job was working at a morgue. And so I was cleaning and washing bodies and preparing for funerals and all of that kind of stuff. And it was this really harrowing experience of like facing your own possible fate and dealing with seeing dead people who died of like aneurysms and cancer and suicides to the head and all other sorts of things. But it ended up being the best job in the world. And it taught me so much about people. And I grew to love older people and hearing all their crazy stories at the funerals and just loved it. And so this kind of draws on that time in my life. So I would say it's fiction based on truth, like most fiction. This story has had three versions. The first version I published was 20 pages. The second version I published was 3 pages. And now this one's kind of in between. So I think this is the best version. So you're going to get the modified version. This story is called Hunger. Ms. Helena Mays has the largest thighs I have ever seen. And this is one of the problems I have with moving her. They are the color of a thick white paste, and their texture is like the white of a hard-boiled egg left in the pot a minute too long, stiff and rubbery. Their blue veins lay out many routes, ones I doubt she has ever taken, and they are fully pocketed by mounds of cellulite and stretch marks. I move her thighs together. They cling like two stubborn magnets until I operate the lift. Then they fall apart like a broken wishbone, one pointing to the left, the other falling away to the right and bending at the knee, her feet banging on the metal basin underneath. For a minute, I think she will collapse to the linoleum, only a few weeks old, part of a pricey remodel. I stretch my arms out as though I could manage to catch all 342 pounds of her. But she doesn't fall. She stays still on the lift, and I breathe a sigh of relief. It is 3:16 in the morning, and I still have 3 hours to go before my shift ends, and I return home to sleep and nurse my ongoing headache for a while, and then return to writing Sestina's. Helena's funeral is in 7 hours, and she needs to look presentable, I reason, and so I need to get rid of all the many end words I could use to frame this moment. Engorged, famished, veneer, supple, pernicious, benevolent. I wipe my gloved hands over my dirty white apron and consider all of the many reasons I shouldn't be here. Ms. Helena Mays is dead, for one. She has everything to be feared. Her auburn hair is matted from her own sweat to the side of her face. The room smells like urine and feces and blood, aggregates from her soiled hospital gown. The smell of urine is all I have to trace the last hours of Helena. I picture her connected to rinds of plastic tubing, a catheter lodged between her fleshy thighs, coarse hairs curled around it. She wouldn't have noticed the smell. She would have in the beginning, I suppose, but then it would have faded away like so many other things. The pain had vanished. At least that is what her medical record declared. Upon death at 22:40 and for an hour before it, she had felt nothing at all. I close my eyes again and feel the familiarity of my headache. The room is a swirl of aquamarine. My mother insisted that I go to a doctor, never mind the cost, and take care of my health. She insisted that it was caused by stress, that once removed, my headaches would disappear and I would be left with nothing, not even a shadow of pain. I steady Helena's body over the basin, locking in the tray with the levers. It's strange to do this alone. Mr. Heinemann is in the corner office, filling out forms. I can hear the echo of his keys as he hits them one by one with his left index finger. He's turned down my offer of typing lessons again and again, telling me he has no hope. Later, he told me to go home, get married, and get a law degree. But the other day, he had suggested that, while he didn't care for keyboard lessons, maybe there was something I could teach him. That is another reason I shouldn't be here. Heinemann Mortuary was one of those places I never noticed. It was tucked behind trees, nested in the bellows of a hillside. I had been driving in circles for 20 minutes before I gave up on the GPS and pulled into a gas station for directions. Radford, in the southwest corner of Virginia, was not a place I frequented, but I drove through it a few times on the way to the airport in North Carolina. I rolled down my window in front of the gas station, feeling slightly sick. Even with the air conditioning, the heat seeped into my car, throwing its arms all over me like a needy child. At night, I ran the air conditioner in my apartment, even though I couldn't afford it, trying to pull the stickiness from my body. It was June, and everything was repulsive to the touch. The problem was that I was only given a teaching stipend for 9 months, and that rent continued for an entire year. Jobs in town were scarce for students, but I had been lucky enough to get a job at the Roanoke Memorial Hospital in the emergency room, which helped me to adjust to working graveyard shifts. My work soon ended due to budget cuts, and Dr. Gunther referred me to Heinemann. John D. Heinemann told me that it was getting harder and harder to do the work. I could be next, he said with a laugh, and who would bury me? You shouldn't be so morbid, I warned him. Listen, he said, if you're going to work here, you've got to get good and ready with a morbid sensibility. You don't have to go as far as my son. Dead baby jokes are a little in poor taste when faced with the reality, but you do have to have a sense of humor, otherwise you'll never last. I had always spent time around men over 6 feet in height. My brothers were tall and scrawny. Mr. Heinemann had a long, sharp nose and dark eyebrows that didn't match the color of his hair. His wedding ring was tarnished, and I couldn't make out if it was gold or silver. His wife was a huge part of the business, he had told me, but she didn't like being around the deceased, and she rarely came downstairs. Been together since grade school, he told me. Wife runs the books. She's bound to do your payroll, too. She'll make sure you're compensated. When he stopped to ask me if I had any questions, I had a million running through my mind. But instead, I just asked him where he was from. Mr. Heinemann's voice had a muddled accent, something between Georgia and North Carolina. Fairfax, he admitted, born and raised. Once you're in Southwest Virginia, your only way out is through this building. Helena was no one that anyone would want to touch, I realize. The color of her skin is garish underneath the fluorescent light. Her body looks as though it is almost ready to split at the seams. For a moment, I wonder what would spill out of her. The melted Sour Patch Kids that I had removed from the plastic bag from the hospital. The red atomic fireballs her daughter said she enjoyed. The candied yams she had asked for over and over again during the last days of her NPO diet. Helena wanted her daughter. The notes in the copy of her medical chart mention how many times she asked for her. 203. Or is it 208? I can't make out the blue pen that looks as though it was hurriedly slashed across the page, not having any medical relevance. In the end, Helena's hunger remains. Her daughter wasn't interested in assisting with the watching or dressing of her mother's body. Why? She asked after signing the form. Her arms were thick with tattoos that ran an illegible map of how far she had gone to make herself stand out and, at the same time, be left alone. And her eyes, which had the soft film of tenderness, were lined heavily. The effect of the dark liner and the contrast with her pale skin made her look alien. It can be a nice thing to do, I began. Really, it's the last act of service you'll be able to do for your mother. I can't handle being around dead people. I don't know how you do it, she said. Now I slip a rag over Helena's body to begin the cleaning process. She is wide like the desert, hollow like the emptiness in the room. It is incredibly hard to move her limbs as they have started to harden from rigor. I wonder what she would think here now, feeling the tautness of her body that has never been anything other than plush. The solvent is strong, and for a minute my eyes burn even through the goggles, and I try to trace the steps of how she got here, large and immobile, alone and cold. I begin by scrubbing the remnants of the hospital tape from her forearms. I clean around the IV marks left behind when her vein blew out. I scrub her collarbone, following the tradition to leave the head and neck for last. Her breasts resemble fried eggs, not exactly round, but large and almost repulsive. I close my eyes in the beginning to wash them. Perhaps a man had once been here, moved his palm over them. She has a daughter, I remind myself, and yet her body doesn't have the fingerprints love would have left behind, the gentleness or care. All she has is the thorn bush of stretch marks running down her sides. Her legs haven't been used in a while. They have the redness of bed sores, the knotted veins between the shins and calves. They are also covered with soft brown hair. I wipe the rag over them, scrubbing the dirt, trying not to imagine the germs floating down the drain. Then I slowly lather her legs with shaving cream and begin to run the razor. The hairs float in the basin, and I pull the clumps from the drain with my gloved hands and throw them in the trash. After the cleaning and dressing of bodies was finished, Mr. Heinemann and I would spend hours talking in the basement. He had a knowledge of Derrida and an ability to tie it in with anatomy. He talked about Aristotle and how he set the standards for surgery. He tied car crash victims in with Van Gogh, and he talked about the philosophy of resurrection, though he had left many of his Baptist roots behind, joining instead with his wife's once-in-a-while Methodist attendance. He was interested in what I had grown up with in Utah and wanted to know about the Book of Mormon, though he admitted he would probably never read it. After work on Wednesday, we sat for 3 hours and talked. It was 4:30, and I still had a Villanelle to finish and another to critique. My head had started to swim. I had been working for almost 4 months and had become quite efficient at the morgue, but instead I had headaches. I thought they were from stress or anxiety, but Wednesday morning it felt different. "Are you all right?" Mr. Heinemann asked. "Forgive the cliche, but you look white as a ghost." I nodded, trying to resume the conversation where we left off. There was something about Machiavelli, but all I could see was the slant of the tiled floor. My head pulsed with pain, and I thought it must resemble a neon sign. I felt shaky, and I had started to sweat. And then I closed my eyes and rolled back, only feeling my head hit the floor. My mom wanted me to quit. She wanted me to quit school, quit writing, quit scheming for success, and marry the first decent man I met. She talked for long hours about all the reasons I shouldn't be in Virginia while I had laid in bed at the Radford Hospital. She blamed the accident on words and my plans for success. "There are perfectly good writing schools in Utah," she told me. "What's wrong with BYU? I don't know why you wanted to go all the way out there." Out there, in the hospital, dressed in a paper gown and awaiting the results of an MRI with no one in the room. At first, it didn't make any sense, but then it began to. Now I wonder what kind of conversations Helena had with her mother. Did she leave confused? Did she ever feel that she could be something? Did she feel as though she was bound to disappoint everyone? I am almost sure that her mother cautioned her about her eating. She may have made snide comments when she went for a second helping of butter-slathered collard greens. She may not have approved of the faded tattoo on her daughter's ankle. When I turn Helena's leg, I can't make out what it is. It could be a faded cross, a Celtic star. But now, all that remains is an unsightly black glob, meaningless to anyone. Her daughter, now 30, with 3 children of her own, dropped off a garbage bag with her mother's clothes in it that morning. Inside, I find a dark, wrinkled skirt, square-toed shoes, a white knit shirt with reams of yellow sweat stained into the armpits, a light purple button-down cardigan with balls of wool. The purple will look horrific against the white of Helena's skin. It will show up all the bruises, the bumps the hospital made when bagging her, the way Mr. Heinemann hit her head into the back of the car before he tightened the gears of the cart. When I sort through the plastic bag of her belongings from the hospital, I find a keychain with a plastic Rubik's cube, a tube of cherry lip gloss, her cell phone, her wallet filled with torn pictures of her grandkids. I tried to make out their smiling faces, but they look like aliens. The light was distorted when the picture was taken. For a moment, I think there must be more for Helena, but there is only this. When Mr. Heinemann came to pick me up from the hospital, he told me he was so relieved that I was well and ready to go back to work. "I was worried I'd have to find someone else," he started. "You don't know how hard it is to find someone to take a job like this. Plus, I don't know if anyone has your inquisitive nature." I moved slowly, assuring him that I was fine and that I needed to go home and rest. I didn't tell him about the small mass they found, the tumor inside my head. There were pictures that the doctor held up against the light in the room, showing me the dark orb in my occipital lobe. He told me not to panic, but he told me to be decisive and to go see a specialist. Be decisive, as though I could take away the curse. "Tell everyone you know for support," he told me. My mother reacted with fear, blaming the school and the long, convoluted road of the past. I thought about blurting out the obvious. Instead, I told Mr. Heinemann that it was nothing more than an episode of dehydration. "You can get through that," he told me. "That's simple. After Mr. Hindman insisted on picking me up after getting a body and bringing me to work. He didn't want me driving alone at night, and as I really wasn't supposed to drive at all. I had just started taking an anti-seizure medication common to epileptics, and it made me insanely tired. I watched his hands in the dim light when he steered the wheel. His fingers were always immaculately clean. Helena is not one of those that is easy to talk to. The easiest for me is the old women. I tell them all about school and my family while I wash them. I try to work out problems by asking them for financial advice or asking them what I should do so that I can stop hitting heads with my mother. Usually there is a calm feeling that comes, as though they are reminding me that I already know the answer. Why not trust myself? I tell them about their families, how they wanted to help dress them, but they were just too sad. Mr. Hindman and his son laugh at me, tell me I am crazy, but it is hard to do this kind of work in silence. Mr. Hindman moved a radio down to the basement, assuring me that I could put it on jazz station or something. But I can't imagine knowing what someone would want to listen to while he or she is cleaned and dressed for burial. The nurses had written that Helena was unusually quiet and that the only time she would talk was to complain. I squint a little, trying to see if the shape of her mouth would open to reveal millions of things that had annoyed her. Her lips are small and pink. In some ways, it looks as though she doesn't have a mouth, but that her cheeks have swallowed it instead. Tell me about yourself, I tell her. What were you like? Helena says nothing. For a minute, I think about shaking her. Tell me something, I want to demand. But I look at how exhausted she seems, worn out even in death. Perhaps she would be a woman I would want very little to do with. Yet, I know that I can usually tell these things right away. You must want something, I tell her again, trying to bait her into a response. All I can hear is the raucous sound of silence, the water dripping from the tap as I wet her legs to make them pliable. I nod a little, understanding then. I go to the radio and turn it on, the most popular country station. I want to be loved like that. Sounds, and I turn the dial down a little, but the music still seeps into the room. I work in silence, listening to the guitar. Aren't people from Utah married at 16? Mr. Hindman asked me one night. I was finishing up with Mrs. Ramona Reed, a huge fan of my idea for my poem for my form and theory class. I wanted to write about playing the violin in the sonnet form, but when I recited the verses, all that came out was the tumor. Some are, I said, and some aren't. It just doesn't make sense, he said again. Don't you crave to be with anyone? I don't get it. You're smart and you're not ugly. What's the problem? Ugly people get married. Smart people too. Yes, I know. That came out wrong. That's not what I meant. Don't you want to have someone around? Don't you get lonely? I shrugged. I had people to talk to. A brother, a sister, my mom, a few colleagues, a friend in West Virginia. It's not like you're bad with people. Don't you want someone around? You can't force love, I told him. Don't you want someone to touch you? I said nothing, reaching for Ramona's dark hand. I looked down, trying to disappear into the tile. I felt him press his hands against me, trace my hips then. His touch was sharp and my skin filled with discomfort. His breath felt hot against my ear. Why are you so afraid? Let me help you. You're hungry for it. I closed my eyes, panicked. I wanted Ramona to spring up, bash him in the head with her cane that I laid on the basin. Instead, I felt the emptiness around me, the disappointment again. Perhaps he always wanted me in this way, a voice sounded in my head. Perhaps it was wrong to think of him as a father or even a friend. Then I pushed the basin, prying his fingers from my side, stepping away and holding my hand up. Where is the tumor now? I wondered why it didn't activate, causing me to crash to the floor. Maybe this was all the future held, a limited escape from endless hunger. I wanted the blank sheet of paper then. I wanted a bulletproof poem that my mother would praise despite the actuality of death and tragedy and pain. I had pages of those verses on my computer at home, their words bleeding through my brain, the pelting rhythm of N-words. For once, I was full. Mr. Hindman flushed a little and then shrugged. My mistake. I'd be with you. You know I would. If you get desperate, I'm here. I'd even pay you, since I know you're short on cash. What would you do for it? Think about it. You're running out of time. Helena's makeup looks cakey underneath the white. I tried to work with the tissue enhancer, but I must admit that I did a good job on her eyes. Helena, though not beautiful, does look like she is rusting. The wear has been washed away from her eyes, and the tissue enhancer got rid of the bags. Her arms lay crossed over her chest with a sprig of lilacs between them. I picked out the flowers because of the color of her cardigan. Her pastor, his wife, three neighbors, two cousins, and I attend her funeral. Mr. Heineman lurks in the background. We barely speak. Gone are the days of Derrida and Quintilian. We now focus on budgets, payroll, funeral arrangements, and burials. Occasionally, he smiles at me in that way that tells me that he still wants something. The other day, he mentioned a poem of mine that he had found online. I like the language, but it all seems so lonely, he said. Is everything you write a tragedy? Helena's pastor waits for 20 minutes until he gets up and starts speaking. I expect to see Helena's daughter come in with her three children, the smell of cigarettes and tanning lotion in the air. Instead, there is no one, and Mrs. Heineman eventually comes into the room and takes her place at the back, nodding at me. Helena's pastor talks about immortality and how Helena is in a much happier place now. I narrow my eyes a little to see if Helena agrees. She doesn't move. It's so sad that this is what it comes to for some people, Mrs. Heineman says after. We stand outside, looking at the leaves of late fall. I nod absently, focusing on the lines of my sestina that I have been rolling over in my head. After it's over, I leave, knowing that I will never go back. I don't bother to remove any of my belongings from my locker, and I don't care about picking up my final check. For a second, I wonder what Mr. Heineman will think. I feel the weight of, once again, causing disappointment. I go home, take my medicine, and rub my pulsing temples, and open the page, throwing my six N-words on the screen. Empty, wide, lonely, filled, bruised, hunger. And call it, for Helena, a sestina. My professor praises the poem, though she tells me that I really need to find something more in life than pain. Over Helena's gravesite, I read it one wintry day. I wipe the flakes from her stone and whisper the lines. I close my eyes and listen. There is so much silence, not even the faraway sound of traffic or trains. But for a minute, I swear that Helena whispers her approval. Thank you.